From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. Protests continue across the country today after the Minnesota Department of Human Rights announced it will launch an investigation into the Minneapolis Police Department over the death of George Floyd. In a moment, we'll hear from the only black member of President Trump's cabinet, Dr. Ben Carson.
But first, in Minneapolis last night, Roxy Washington, the mother of Floyd's six-year-old daughter, Gianna, spoke publicly for the first time about his death.
I'm here for my baby. And I'm here for George because I want justice for him. I want justice for him because he was good. No matter what anybody thinks, he was good.
Patrice Cullors joins us now on Skype. She co-founded Black Lives Matter in 2013. And Patrice, since 2013, we've seen mass protests against police violence in Ferguson, Missouri after the killing of Michael Brown, in Baltimore after the death of Freddie Gray, really across the country. And now we're here again. Does this moment feel different to you?
This moment feels a lot of the same. A lot of the same kind of pain, a lot of the same kind of rage, but different because last time we experienced this moment, we didn't have as much national organization around what to do. And we've spent the last 7 years building out deep ties across the country because if we knew we would have a moment like this again, and now we get to actually respond differently.
We've seen some police officers face consequences amid these protests. In Minneapolis, the officer who knelt on George Floyd's neck for more than 8 minutes has been charged. The mayor of Louisville fired his chief of police after the killing of a store owner there. What do you think would constitute justice in this moment that we're in right now?
For a lot of people, they want accountability for what these officers have done. So some people are asking for prosecuting law enforcement. I think that's a fine demand, and I think that's not a demand rooted in us being able to change the system. It's holding an individual accountable for their actions, an individual that is tied to an institution that has caused a lot of destruction. So I get that demand, but I do think that the demand of defunding law enforcement becomes a central demand and how we actually get real accountability and justice, because it means that we are reducing the ability for law enforcement to have resources that harm our communities. And with that demand, it's not just about taking away money from the police. It's about reinvesting those dollars into Black communities, communities that have been deeply divested from, communities that some have never felt the impact of having true resources. And so we have to reconsider what we're resourcing. I've been saying we have an economy of punishment over an economy of care.
But what do you say to this argument that it's not that less money is needed to be spent on police, but actually reallocating the way that money is spent so that police can be used for the good of communities and not in opposition of them?
Oh, it's not possible for law enforcement, the entity of law enforcement, to be a compassionate, caring governmental agency in Black communities. That's not the training. That's not the institution. We have spent the last seven years asking for training, asking for body cameras. The body cameras have done nothing more than show us what's happening over and over again. The training has done nothing but show us that law enforcement and the culture of law enforcement is incapable of changing. And so what we're asking for is a reinvestment in how we understand what's needed in our communities. Why is law enforcement the first responders for mental health crisis? Why are the first responders for domestic violence issues? Why are they the first responders for homelessness? And so those are the first places we can look into, let alone let's talk about law enforcement's ability to surveil the community and how much money they're given in surveillance dollars every single year. The public has allowed for us to have militarized police forces in our communities, and we have to stop it.
So do you think, you know, we've been talking a lot about these videos that have gone viral of protests around the country of police officers kneeling and marching with protesters, do you see these as distractions, or are you encouraged by these moments, or do you feel like they're PR?
Colin Kaepernick was banned from the NFL for taking a knee for Black people, specifically looking at the ways law enforcement violence has impacted us. When the police take a knee, not only do I not take it seriously, it's disingenuous. Taking a knee is not stopping the deaths of our community members. We need radical shifts. We need transformation. These things don't happen through police taking a knee at protests and then right after they take a knee, getting up and tear gassing us and rubber bulleting us and beating us with batons.
That's Patrice Cullors. She is one of the co-founders of Black Lives Matter. Patrice, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Now let's get more of my interview with Housing Secretary Ben Carson, the only African-American in President Trump's cabinet. He told me today he understood the anger over George Floyd's death.
You know, seeing what happened in Minneapolis is horrifying. And, you know, I, like everyone else, want to see justice here.
But Carson also told me he's disappointed that some protesters are looting businesses, and he said that he doesn't understand why some people see President Trump's response as hateful. You can hear our full interview about the protests at hereandnow.org. Carson is also a medical doctor and one of the top officials overseeing the response to the coronavirus pandemic. I asked him about that. Secretary Carson, as you know, this is all happening in the midst of the pandemic, which is hurting the Black community disproportionately hard. You are a member of the president's coronavirus task force. Black Americans dying at nearly three times the rate of white Americans in this country. Why do you think that is, and what are you doing about it?
Why? The obvious answer is because of the comorbidities, you know, hypertension, diabetes, obesity, asthma, et cetera. But you really have to go to the next layer beneath that and say, why do those things exist more in those communities? If you don't address it at that level, you're just putting a Band-Aid on it. So that means we have to address housing. It means we have to look at people's health care needs over the long run. They have to have long-term health care. Unless you have that long-term continuous care, you're not really doing anything except making yourself feel good. We have to.
So why is the administration then arguing in court to invalidate Obamacare? Because isn't that about getting people long-term care, especially people who otherwise would not have health insurance?
Well, you know, there are some who feel that that's the answer. There are some who feel that maybe there are better answers. You know, ask yourself just this question. How much money is spent every year on each person in Medicaid? The answer is about $9,100. Is there a better way to spend that much money to make sure that people get the kind of care that they should have? Those are the kind of questions that should be asked by all of us.
You brought up housing. You established a moratorium on foreclosures and evictions for homes that expires at the end of this month. Do you think that that should be extended, or is July 1st the appropriate moment for Americans to start paying their rent or mortgage or face consequences?
Well, we're already in the process of assessing that question. And obviously, if more extensions are needed, they will be granted.
I just want to finally ask you just a couple of questions about coronavirus. Are you prepared as a member of the task force for a second wave of the virus? And do you think states will have to shut down again if there is a second wave?
If is the key word there, because it's not clear that there will be a second wave. But if, in fact, there is, obviously, we're much better prepared for it now than we were previously. I think it still is incumbent upon us to emphasize to people that the guidelines are necessary and appropriate in terms of social distancing, in terms of wearing masks when you cannot social distance, in terms of hand washing, until we have eliminated the threat or until such time as we have effective vaccinations or cures.
Do you believe there should be political conventions in August with tens of thousands of people in arenas?
I think what we really need to ask ourselves is, do we have other possibilities? What are the ways that we can still maintain safety?
So it sounds like you're saying probably not in arenas with tens of thousands of people.
Unless we can come up with things that are consistent with what we know are safe practices.
That is Ben Carson, the U.S. Secretary of Housing and Urban Development. Secretary Carson, thank you very much for taking our questions today.
It's been a pleasure. Take care.
And you can hear more of our interview with Ben Carson at hereandnow.org.
It feels like nothing in the news these days makes any sense. So Hassan Minhaj turned to his father and his faith for answers.
He said, don't worry about the number of questions. Just worry about which questions become more clear and solidified.
Comedian Hassan Minhaj on how his spirituality is getting him through. Listen and subscribe to It's Been a Minute from NPR.
Journalists covering the protests over George Floyd's death are coming under attack themselves. An anchor for Australia's 7 News was outside of the White House this week when this happened.
We've just had to run about a block as police moved in. We've been fired at with rubber bullets. My cameraman has been hit. We've also seen tear gas being used. Here we go, they're moving through again. This is exactly what it looks like.
That video shut off when the cameraman was punched by a police officer. Well, adding to the physical violence, the media industry has been decimated by the loss of ad revenue caused by the pandemic. NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik joins us now with more on this. Hi, David.
Hey, Jeremy.
Well, I want to start with what was happening even before these protests. Just in the last 2 months, we saw The Atlantic lay off nearly 20% of its staff. The LA Times cut pay by 20% until August. McClatchy furloughed around 4% of its staff at 30 papers around the country. What's going on, first of all, with the big print companies right now?
Yeah, let's not forget Gannett, which owns well over 100 newspapers. Dailies has furloughed employees 1 week out of every month for the next several months, and it's not clear that won't continue into the future. You know, these were companies that were really financially getting crunched before the pandemic. Some of them through self-inflicted wounds, some of them through debt. McClatchy's trying to go through bankruptcy and come out the other side. And then the pandemic hits. And it's really vaporized a lot of the advertising base that still sustained the print editions for what we think of as old-fashioned news organizations in print. And that's been important. A lot of the smaller news organizations have seen some digital subscriptions help them, but not enough. And they're trying to build, and they're seeing some success during these waves, these layers of crises affecting us as people are turning to reliable news. But, you know, they've got a lot of ground to make up. Print ads pay so much more than digital, and digital ads have a lot of them have gone away.
Well, and when it comes to the smaller publications, the Times-Picayune, NOLA.com furloughed 10% of staffers temporarily. The Stranger in Seattle suspended print and laid off 18 people. You know, the last several years, we've talked many times about the importance of local newspapers in America. Are they going to be able to recover from this?
Yeah, I think there's a sizable number that won't. If you think about those news weeklies, those alternative weeklies, a lot of them seem to me to be on a razor's edge. If you think about newspapers in smaller regions, more sparsely populated, where they've been expected to distribute them, that's expensive. A lot of those places don't have financial padding to sustain for months and months of this kind of economic pressure. I think a significant number are going to go out of business in ways that are not going to be easily replaced.
And what do we lose when that happens, David?
I think we lose the texture of our lives in many cases. I think you endure the understanding of what happens to your neighbors across town or even just down the block. You don't see the full understanding of the rhythms of a community, and you don't have an accountability to the same extent of government agencies and major institutions and players in a region, in a community. There may be more hands that are hidden, so to speak, in communities that have increasingly constricted news outlets. And in this case, not constricted by government pressure, but in this case, by just unfathomably large economic pressures that may sweep some of these away.
Broadcast media are not immune from this. CBS News cut 75 jobs last week. President Susan Zirinsky told employees on a Zoom meeting she was really sorry. NPR has furloughed workers, as has American Public Media. What's happening in broadcast media right now?
Well, let's take CBS. You know, a lot of those cuts are because of cost trimming around the COVID crisis. But what you're seeing there is the result of corporate decisions. The decision to merge Viacom back with CBS. They had once been part of the same company, were split apart, now brought back together in a way that requires for it to make sense to make cuts. In this case, Susan Zirinsky, the head of CBS News, said this is painful, but this is what we have to do. And I'm sure that the economic crisis caused by COVID is part of that as well.
Let's talk about the protests. The group U.S. Press Freedom Tracker says it's investigating more than 100 incidents of journalists being targeted during protests. There have been numerous stories of reporters hit by rubber bullets or arrested even after identifying themselves. What do you make of that? Is this just random incidents where police happen to be going after reporters, or is there something else going on here?
You know, you haven't seen some major law enforcement official come forward like Bull Connor in the civil rights days to say, yeah, you're darn right we're going after them. And at the same time, it's too consistent in city after city, reporters not simply getting caught up in the melee, but being singled out. Yes, there have been reporters arrested, but there have also been reporters hit, as you say, by rubber bullets, hit by tear gas canisters. I talked to Molly Hennessy Fisk of the Los Angeles Times, a hardened war correspondent, as well as experienced police reporter. She had a gaping wound in her leg after being hit by a tear gas canister. And you saw a reporter from the Wall Street Journal being essentially hit repeatedly and intentionally, even though it's very clear that he's a reporter and identified as such, by a cop using his riot shield to kind of club the reporter. And you haven't seen police chiefs all over, with a few exceptions, coming out and saying, I'm sorry, that's not an example of our policies, our procedures. There was one case, our public radio colleague Adolfo Guzman Lopez of KPCC Southern California Public Radio, where he was shot in the throat with a rubber bullet, really bruised and bled. It caused a real wound there. And the police chief and the mayor of Long Beach, California did come out and apologize to him. But that's been more the exception than the rule. I think you've seen this in towns from D.C. to Denver. It seems in some ways to have been hardened by rhetoric from the top, where police unions have been strongly in support in many cities of the president, and his rhetoric against the press seems to be part of that.
Well, and are you concerned based on all of this? And as you say, the president has called media organizations fake news, enemies of the people, that the First Amendment, the protection of the freedom of the press, those protections are being eroded right now.
I think that's certainly a fair conclusion, at least in this precise moment. I'm not saying enduringly, but, you know, patterns of behavior can have ways of becoming norms. So let's remember, the First Amendment and freedom of speech applies to all Americans. There's no licensing for journalists that gives us a ton of extra protections, although there are some around the margins about our behavior. Reporters are often allowed to go behind police lines to interview people on both sides of a protest. But really, it's meant to protect all Americans. But if someone from Rupert Murdoch's Wall Street Journal, if someone from CNN can get arrested, even though they're backed not only by one of the nation's largest news organizations, but by parent company AT&T, a huge multinational giant. If those people can't have their freedom of speech, essentially, of the press, respected by police, what can ordinary citizens expect who don't have such gigantic figures in institutions behind them? What can they expect for their freedom to assemble, their freedom to speak? I think that's a real question that hangs over all of this. And I think that's why paying attention to what happens to journalism is important, both because it affects what kind of news coverage we can offer the public, but it also serves as a warning for what the public itself can expect at the hands of the people who act under the color of public authority.
That is NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. David, thanks as always.
You bet.
All 50 states are now at various stages of reopening their economies, which is good news for businesses, and just in time for certain outdoor projects to get back on track, including small-time gardening and landscape contractors. KQED's Marco Seiler-Gonzalez reports from the San Francisco Bay Area.
There's an upside to being in the landscaping business during a shelter-in-place order. Homeowners are stuck at their homes, examining every overgrown weed and patch of dirt.
A lot of people have these huge backyard spaces that are just untouched.
That's Jason Hiller. He owns Forever Green Landscape in San Francisco.
And we're able to go in there and transform them into these killer, like, outdoor space where, you know, the adults can have a space and then the kids can have their little play area too.
When the local health order allowed outdoor work to resume on May 3rd, Hiller says his phone and email blew up with calls for help.
Hey, we got this house, we got this yard, you know, and we got two kids and a dog, and we want to do a kid-friendly garden.
I met Hiller at James Parrish's house in the city's Sunset District. Parrish hired Hiller last year to landscape his backyard. Parrish leads us into an outdoor tiki lounge. Bottles of rum and tiki cups line the shelves of the bar. There's a big tan surfboard that hangs above them.
My wife is so glad that this stuff is out of the house now. All my tiki stuff all over the place.
I'm blown away.
So now it's got a place to go. And more importantly, we have a place to go.
The bar leads down to a turf lawn. Plants line the fence. And a big trampoline lies on a brick patio at the very back. Parrish is a firefighter stationed in the Bayview, one of the city district's hardest hit by COVID-19.
It's been a godsend, man. You know, work is a little more stressful for me than it was before a couple months ago. So when I come home, I really need to decompress.
Parrish's enthusiasm for his garden isn't unique. Nurseries have reported skyrocketing sales on veggies, herbs, and soil since shelter-in-place began. One nursery owner in Oakland says his revenue tripled between March and May compared to all of last year. But the story wasn't the same for wholesale retailers who sell strictly to licensed contractors like Jason Hiller, contractors who couldn't work during the shelter-in-place order. Don Baldacci is the president of Pacific Nurseries in Colma. He said revenue practically came to a halt after the shelter-in-place order took effect in March.
We pretty much had to close down because our customers, the industry out there locally, was shut down as well.
Baldacci oversees 25 acres of land with well over 10,000 plants and trees. He had to furlough nearly all 60 of his employees, but he secured a loan through the Federal Payroll Protection Program by mid-April.
I was amazed, but we made it. As soon as that happened, I got on the phone and got everybody who was willing to come back to come back.
Now, Baldacci says there's a steady stream of contractors coming through the nursery. Hiller and other landscapers say they have a lot of projects lined up for clients looking to invest in some green space. For Here and Now, I'm Marco Salar Gonzalez.
There's some positive news on the possibility of 100 million doses of a COVID-19 vaccine being available by the end of the year. Dr. Anthony Fauci made the announcement yesterday, but he also said a vaccine may not provide long-term immunity. So until a vaccine is ready, health experts will use contact tracing to try to stop the spread of the virus. But there are fears the technique may not work as well in the U.S. as in other parts of the country, in other countries. For more, let's bring in Drew Joseph with our partners at STAT, the Health and Medicine publication. Drew, thanks for joining us.
Thanks very much.
Other countries like South Korea were really able to successfully cut the number of new cases through contact tracing. What's different here in the U.S.?
Yeah, so there are a couple things. First of all, contact tracing is part of a broader surveillance network, and that includes widespread testing as well. And experts have raised two concerns about how successful it might be. One is that although we're down, there are still some 20,000 cases reported every day in the country. And that's just a lot of cases to try to interview and see where those people have been and who they've been in touch with. So contact tracing really works when there's a manageable number of cases. And so there's a question of if we still have too many infections for contact tracing to really work. The second thing is more of a political and cultural thing. There's a fear that the response has become so politicized that some people just won't cooperate with efforts to quarantine people, to ask people where they've been, if they are infected. So there's a fear about that.
Yeah. Take us through how contact tracing actually works.
Right. So contact tracing is not a new thing. It's been around for years and years, and it's done, you know, for diseases like HIV and tuberculosis. And so how it works is a contact tracer will call someone who's has the virus, and they're often the ones who inform them they have the virus. And then in addition to providing information about the virus, they're also going to ask about where that person's been in the past couple of days, whom they've had contact with, and try to reach out to those people as well. And with COVID-19, a contact is defined as someone who's been within 6 feet of that person for 15 minutes at least. Then what happens is the contact tracer reaches out to people, those contacts as they're called, and lets them know they might have been exposed to the virus and asks them to quarantine themselves for up to 14 days. And then that can sort of depend on if and when they can get tested as well. So it is a potentially a big ask for people.
Yeah. I want to go back to that cultural element that you talked about. Earlier this week, Congress outlined a plan to regulate digital contact tracing apps that we've been hearing so much about to protect people's privacy. What do we know about that bill?
You know, you mentioned South Korea earlier, and South Korea has been immensely successful with contact tracing, but, you know, they've in some cases relied on credit card data and cell phone data to look at which people were at which nightclubs. And I just don't think that's just probably won't fly in the United States, where privacy is just a much bigger concern. And there's a question about should apps, for example, track people and where they've been, so to help keep tabs on tracing. You know, there's proposals so that, you know, you'll get a notification on your phone if you've come into contact with someone who later tests positive. But the bill you mentioned would basically ensure that public health agencies have input over these apps that are being developed, and it's not just totally left up to the private sector because of the privacy concerns involved.
That's Drew Joseph with our partners at STAT, the Health and Medicine Publication. Thank you so much.
Thanks very much.
In this moment, Black police officers are facing the intersection of their identities and their profession. Black police are also making up a declining percentage of officers in many departments, which is in part due to years of deep mistrust. Joining me now is Charles P. Wilson, the national chairman of the National Association of Black Law Enforcement Officers. Welcome.
Thank you.
Charles, you were an officer for a long time. You're retired now. What is it like to look at those images we're seeing on the news and see from afar what's happening in this moment?
It's disturbing. It's disappointing. The images that I saw of, obviously everyone has seen, of how George Floyd died. Putting a knee on somebody's neck for more than 9 minutes has no place whatsoever in the law enforcement practitioner. You know, am I surprised that it happened? No.
Hmm.
You know, what people have to recognize and accept, the institution of policing has been inherently biased against people of color and low income, and it was designed to be that way. So the actions of the officers are not surprising, okay?
I want to talk to you a little bit about what you're saying about the design, that it's inherent, that it's part of the system. You're talking specifically about the images we've seen of George Floyd, but you know these protests that we're watching, while there are these images of officers joining protesters, there are other images we're seeing of officers deliberately spraying peaceful protesters with tear gas, stomping on peaceful protesters as they sit on the ground, slamming them against buildings. Those latter images and what happened to George Floyd speak to the moment that we're in right now, a deep distrust by Americans and arguments that brutality as a form of control is actually an inherent part of policing.
Yes, it is.
Say more.
Again, the system itself was designed to work this way. Now, admittedly, it was initially started to keep poor people under control, to ensure that the rich or more well-to-do were able to maintain their status. When Black folks got here, you know, they just fell victim to the system.
Hmm. How does that come into play as a Black police officer? You served as the first Black police chief in a suburb in Cleveland, Ohio from 1988 to the mid-90s.
Yes.
I would imagine there's a level of dual consciousness here of being both a Black person and also a police officer. How did you balance that? And how do Black police officers balance that?
We often say it's an issue of remembering who we are, where we came from, and why we're doing what we do. Of the 9,000 plus members of our organization, all of us are embedded in our communities. We are very strong advocates of the concepts of community policing, fighting against police brutality, misconduct, and excessive use of force. So those people who we come in contact with, they know that we are there for our communities. Now, they also know that we just point blank ain't down for the damage that's being done.
What I'm hearing from you is that, from your view, in many ways, Black police officers play a subversive force in a larger institution of policing through community policing. You feel that having Black officers is vitally important to the entire institution of policing.
We play a very pivotal role, and the research supports that very definitely.
Yeah, you were actually one of the authors of a post published on the London School of Economics, U.S. Center's website, which explains the differences in the way Black officers perceive racial profiling by police, especially in small agencies. It's different than the common assessments of bias. Can you explain more?
We looked at specifically how Black officers perceived their service and worth in the community and their perceptions of whether profiling occurred and whether profiling was being condoned by their agencies. And the overwhelming numbers of officers that we surveyed indicated that, yes, racial profiling does in fact exist in their agencies. And most definitely, there are agencies that condone it. So what we have to look at, who and how you hire. You have to look at what and how you train. You have to look at how and who is supervising your personnel. If you're looking to actually change the culture of the profession, you have to look at the policies that are in place.
But I want to ask you about something else. So here in Los Angeles, Black officers make up about 9% of the police force, but that number could actually dwindle in the coming years because those who make up that percentage were actually hired back in the 80s and the 90s, and they're actually retiring soon. Can you speak to this overall, and then also the effectiveness of those trainings that you're talking about?
Well, see, the first thing you have to look at, again, is how are you hiring people? We know that when they conduct their recruiting programs, they are not properly reaching out to the core constituencies in the Black and brown communities. And if you're not reaching out to those people who have both an inherent and definitive connection to the folks you say you're trying to recruit, you're not recruiting for us. Okay? If you tell me that one of your primary candidates for the job is supposed to be a Black female, and you are not also telling me that you're putting your recruiting information in the hair salons, fitness centers, and shopping centers where every single Black woman I know goes at least once a week, you are not recruiting for Black females. I'm sorry. So the next part of that equation is for police management and administration, and in fact, community legislators, to format policies that provide for getting rid of the idiots. We have to ensure that those people who are working have ample opportunity and incentive to turn those people in, because they're as much of a danger to the law enforcement officer as they are to people in the community.
Do you see us moving in that direction?
It's not as strong and prevalent as it should be, but it is present, okay? During the entire time I was on the job, people knew. If you did something improper or incorrect around me, I was going to blow you away, you know? And once I got supervisory rank, it became a lot easier because I could write them up where they would lose time on the job or lose their jobs completely.
What you speak to is the power of being able to have those higher ranking positions within law enforcement.
We have to.
Yeah. What's it like right now to be a Black police officer in the middle of what is now one of the largest civil unrests in recent history?
It's hard as hell. And I say that tongue in cheek. This entire past week, I've been trying to stay in contact with various people in our membership, Philadelphia, Chicago, New York, New Jersey. I got a notice from one of the officers in New York. They want to do implicit bias training. And I've told them point blank, we've been doing implicit bias training for the last 6 years. And our counterparts are, in fact, coming to those training sessions. So we know that what we're talking works.
That's Charles P. Wilson. He is the national chairman of the National Association of Black Law Enforcement Officers. Thank you so much for joining us.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
And if you're wondering whether that summer trip you had planned can still happen, you're not alone. According to the TSA, twice as many Americans flew at the end of May than at the beginning, suggesting that as the months get warmer, more people are deciding the rewards of travel outweigh the risks. For more, let's bring in Seth Kaplan here, now transportation analyst. Hi, Seth.
Hi, Jeremy.
And we know that air travel is nowhere near where it was pre-pandemic, but give us a sense of how many people are flying right now.
Well, Jeremy, Monday earlier this week was actually the best day since things got bad. About 350,000 Americans passed through TSA security checkpoints. Okay, what's the context there? Well, 350,000 compares to just 88,000 on the worst day back in mid-April. On the other hand, 350,000 also compares to 2.5 million on the equivalent day a year earlier. So much closer to the low than to the previous levels, but at least moving in the right direction.
The last plane I took was in early March and it was nearly empty. How full are the planes these days? Are airlines still keeping the middle seat open?
Some are. Delta, for one, has said through at least the end of July it'll do that. Many aren't. And flights are fuller now than probably what you saw there in late March. We've seen those anecdotal reports of very full flights. Those are the exception. But in terms of the numbers in the aggregate, Alaska Airlines was the one that put out the most detailed figures. It said that in May, Seattle-based Alaska packed about 40% of the seats on its flight. Now, look, that's on a capacity cut of like 80%, right? I mean, they're not flying very much, but they were also flying about that little back in April, and their seats were just about 15% full. So they're too moving in the right direction, and airlines are slowly actually adding seats back to the marketplace. Of course, some airlines more than others, obviously more domestic than international.
But with so few flights and so few seats comparatively, what's going on with prices? I hear that Atlanta to Denver, for example, it's actually gotten more expensive because of the lack of supply. What's going on with prices?
Exactly. You'd be surprised. There are some good advance purchase deals, but at the very beginning of this, you know, you could just hop on a flight, the few people who wanted to, and pay very little. That's not the case anymore. And that's because of, as you said, supply and demand. Not as many people want to fly, but also not as many seats out there. And also consumer psychology. Airlines have kind of figured out that demand right now is low, but what the economists call inelastic. In other words, the few people who are traveling, in many cases, just really want to travel and are actually willing to pay prices something like what we normally pay, despite the overall lack of demand.
What about international travel? We see today that the Trump administration is banning Chinese passenger planes from coming to the U.S. starting later this month. This is in retaliation for Beijing banning U.S. flights. But aside from China, when can Americans start flying abroad again?
Big question, yeah. And all of that, of course, has as much to do with geopolitics as it does to do with COVID. I mean, if anything, depending on what numbers you believe, things have improved more in China in terms of the virus itself than in some other parts of the world. It's really anybody's guess, and it's a patchwork at this point of policies, even in countries that you might think are very similar. You know, you go to the UK, and you are in a 14-day quarantine, pretty much no matter what. But other parts of Europe, that's not the case. So it's really a country-by-country thing at this time. And obviously, when it comes to international travel, a question not just of what people want, of consumer demand, but also what they're allowed to do. And so that's part of the speculation that domestic will rebound first. It's not just a question of people being willing to travel again, but you know, when it comes to domestic, at least you can do it if you've decided it's okay. International travel, a different story.
What about cruises? We're hearing already about cruises starting to open back up later this summer.
Yeah, and if you think things are bad for airlines, things are bad on a whole other level for cruise lines. I mean, they're at zero right now. A few of the major cruise lines are hoping to start sailing again in August. But again, think about international regulations. There are a lot of places they can't go. I can tell you, Jeremy, anecdotally, there's that word again, right? I had a cruise booked in October from Quebec City in Canada down to Boston. That's already canceled because Canada isn't allowing cruises into October. So cruise lines very much at the center of all of this, probably more bad publicity even than the airlines when it comes to the spread of the virus itself. It's going to be a tough slog for them.
And just briefly, Seth, the big question, if you can travel right now, should you? What's the prevailing wisdom right now?
You have to think about your own risk. You have to think about the people around you, the risk to them in the airport and on the airplane. And then you have to think about the people who you're going to visit, if that's the purpose of your trip. And look, the people around you, I mean, they've obviously made the choice, those on the airplane, to also travel. No real difference being in that same space with those same people as if you were around those people in a restaurant or a theater or elsewhere. But then what about what you might be carrying to the people at the destination? You have to think about that too, your relatives and so forth.
Here now, transportation analyst Seth Kaplan, thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.